Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and here's something we'd all like to hear.
The energy bills are up to 50% less.
That's Neshama Abraham with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She says a certain innovation saves money and the environment. In fact,
the energy bills are up to 50% less.
So what is this miracle innovation? Is it A, buying used solar panels? They produce a bit less energy, but cost much less than new ones. Or are we talking about B, higher fuel efficiency standards? Eliminating gas-guzzling cars could save oil and air alike. Or is the breakthrough C, communal living? Co-housing communities are built to be energy efficient. Stumped? Don't go anywhere. The answer is coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Savings and loans, airlines, Chrysler, the next government bailout, the home mortgage holder. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Before we get to the latest housing news, this week's bridge disaster in Minneapolis no doubt rekindled some common questions about how to prepare yourself financially for the worst of times. We've gathered some links to several of our relevant stories, including what kind of insurance to carry, how much cash to have on hand, and how to put together something called a go box. You can find those stories and more at marketplace.org. The first 6 months of this year saw a 58% jump in the rate of home foreclosures. More than 573,000 homes went into default, were repoed, or hit the auction block. That's according to RealtyTrack. The company's CEO predicts that number could soar past 2 million by the end of the year. Several states are setting aside money to help homeowners refinance out of mortgages they can't afford. Chris Mayer joins us with the details. He teaches real estate at Columbia Business School. Chris, who do these programs target?
The people who would benefit most and who are really facing the biggest problems are people whose credit is not very good. I think for people who have good credit, particularly for people who are in houses where the mortgage amount is under $417,000, there really is not going to be a big problem refinancing their credit. And in fact, I think mortgage rates are more or less still very closely tied to the interest rates in the economy, which have been rising but are still at reasonable levels.
Is this a good thing for states to be doing, bailing out homeowners who got into bad mortgages? I mean, couldn't this potentially put a strain on these states' financial systems?
I understand what politicians are trying to do, which is it's really hard to sit back and watch these problems developing, but I also think there's not much they can do. And I think that they're using up fiscal capacity for states in programs that are really just going to be a drop in the bucket. You know, we're talking about 500 or 1,000 homeowners, and that's just too small to make much of a difference.
What would be a better way to help all these folks who are facing foreclosure or short sales or, you know, it's essentially losing their homes because they got into bad mortgages?
I don't think there's much that the states can do or local governments can do to prevent people from losing their homes if they took out mortgages that they now can't afford. I think what states have an obligation to do is to try as much as possible to make sure that there aren't spillover effects where you have neighborhoods that have a lot of boarded up homes, overgrown grass, crime, those kinds of things. And I think the states would be much better off taking these resources to make sure that there aren't ancillary effects that bring down the value of houses for people who haven't gotten into financial trouble yet. That is to stop this from becoming a contagion as much as they can.
How do they go about doing that?
Well, I think one of the things that states and local governments should do is really try and allow the market to work as quickly as possible. That is to say, to make sure that as properties are being foreclosed, that that happens in an orderly and a fair process. But the less time those foreclosed properties are owned by banks, the better, because you really want those properties in the hands of people who are going to live and maintain them. There's going to be increasing political pressure for states to do things to stop people from foreclosing.
Right.
And I think that would be a really big mistake. That will cut off the supply of new credit into those markets. And, you know, it's going to be true. There are going to be people who are really going to be hurt by this. And the temptation is for those people, when they make the headlines of the newspapers, to do something for them. But I think the time to have done something was 2 years ago. It's not now.
Chris Mayer is director of the Milstein Center for Real Estate at Columbia Business School. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
So if you're facing a problem with your mortgage, here's one possible solution. Move into something called co-housing. It's a type of community living dreamed up in Denmark. The concept is still fairly new here, just 100 completed projects, but it's growing at about 20% a year. From WGBH in Boston, Marketplace's Helen Palmer reports.
This is our communal herb garden. Saving a trivial amount of money, but saving an enormous amount of labor, that there is a community herb garden.
Ariane Cherboulier lives in the Cornerstone co-housing in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We talked about co-housing in the community house she shares with her 70 neighbors, like Debbie Gelber.
People will have a separate fancy dining room that they use a few times a year. We have a community dining room that you can sign up for and have your own family party here and not have room in your house that you've paid for that you never use.
And her neighbor, Debbie Gelber, says there are other savings.
We have one lawnmower for 32 units. Imagine if every 32 houses in this country shared a lawnmower, what that would do for carbon emissions, for instance.
Neshama Abraham of the Co-Housing Association says this way of living does a lot for the environment and the residents.
The energy bills are up to 50% less in a co-housing community because the homes are built to be so energy efficient.
But co-housing's not cheap to buy. Ken Thompson's a founding member of Cornerstone in Cambridge.
The rule of thumb generally in co-housing that the price of a unit is likely to be the market rate for a house with that number of bedrooms plus one, because of all the extra common space you're buying into at the same time.
Indeed, a three-bed townhouse currently for sale there has an asking price of $579,000, in line with the high real estate valuations in North Cambridge. But like most co-housing developments, Cornerstone subsidizes some units to keep them affordable for moderate-income households.
That's Javier ringing the dinner bell.
Oh, thank you, Javier.
At Boston's Jamaica Plain co-housing, they were serving the weekly community dinner.
It's your make-your-own vegetarian sushi. Build your own. That's where all the ingredients are, and Maria has prepared.
Jenny Rodemore loves living here. Her one-bedroom unit's the first home she's owned. She sits outside overlooking the central lawn. She says she could only afford the mortgage because the community's affordability fund loaned her 10% of the cost.
Technically, I own 90% of our unit. And when I sell, I have to return the original loan, which was $34,000, and then 10% of any appreciation, if there is any.
Mayors in some urban centres, including Boston, see co-housing as a possible model to keep teachers and other public service workers in cities with high real estate costs. Of course, co-housing has its challenges. Judith Adler of Cornerstone.
We make decisions by consensus, and that requires a lot of time and processing, and that can be a frustration for some people who don't, you know, want to discuss things, you know, ad nauseum for some people.
And Adler says everyone has chores, committees, maintenance, landscaping and the like. And though people do have their own private space, most people know your business in a small community. But most co-housers think the rewards outweigh the problems. 78-year-old Betsy Germanata moved into Cornerstone 5 years ago with her husband, Dante.
From my perspective, because Dante died 3 years ago, I wouldn't have wanted to be anyplace else because of the support.
Now elder co-housing's emerging as an alternative for retirees, so baby boomers are likely to make this movement grow even faster. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. This week we're exploring a term that has nothing to do with those cute Bermudas going for 15% off at Old Navy. No, this short sale is all about gambling.
Hi, I'd like to exchange my rent money for slot tokens.
I see your bet and raise you my son's college tuition.
I'm putting my money on the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Now, that's a gamble. And one equivalent in the stock market is something called a short sale. At the Blackboard this week, economist Chris Lowe.
A short sale is when an investor borrows a stock in order to sell it with the promise that he will buy it back at some future date and give it back. Now, the point of doing this whole exercise is that it allows someone to bet against a stock that he doesn't own. It can be very profitable. The difference between the selling price and the eventual repurchase, if it's at a lower price, all of that is your gain. But it can also be a very dangerous thing to do because when making a short sale, you don't have to pledge any money up front, which means at some point you're going to have to buy back that stock. And if it's up a ton, you're going to have to buy it back at a much higher price than you sold it for. One other kind of short sale that we've been hearing a lot about recently is when there's a mortgage on a house that is quite a bit bigger than the house is worth and the owner has to sell. It's considered a short sale when the bank allows that sale to go through and forgives the balance of the mortgage. We're hearing more and more about those as the subprime meltdown continues and particularly lower-end houses are rapidly losing value. These two definitions are not to be confused. A short sale in the stock market is definitely someone trying to make money, even if it is in a dangerous fashion. Short sale on a house is the bank admitting that made a loan it really shouldn't have made.
Our teacher this week was Chris Loeb. He's the chief economist with FTN Financial in New York. Next week, what exactly is a credit score? From profit sharing to, hey, where's my profit? Chris looks at the effect of corporate buyouts on a popular company perk. And after you hear what this guy's workday is like, you might stop whining about your to-do list.
You know, I've jumped from a lot of planes, dove in shark-infested waters, I've been shot at.
A day in the work life of a combat trainer. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Dude, the X Games are underway here in Los Angeles this weekend. Think of it as the Olympics for people without fear. Competitors fly through the air on dirt bikes and skateboards and generally spend a lot of time as street pizza. No wonder one of the event's sponsors is the U.S. Navy. And on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a former Navy SEAL. He trains soldiers and civilians to handle dangerous situations, but this is no game.
Ready!
Down.
One.
Down.
Two.
Down.
Three.
Down.
My name is Don Mann. I'm a retired Navy SEAL and now I am a security specialist. I train people for special combat operations in high-risk areas.
Okay, we have some people falling on their knees again. We might have to start this over unless we get you guys off your knees.
I think we have our first quitter. He is on his face. He has given up. So you quit, huh, Bowles?
Nope.
Bowles, get up!
Nope. Actions speak louder than words, Bowles. Are you going to quit?
Nope.
I remember even back to first and second grade, I would go out in the woods all by myself and go as far as I can and turn around and try to come back without getting lost. I always loved the outdoors. I liked the edge. I became a motorcycle racer. I loved motocross racing. And every hobby and every sport throughout my life was pretty risky. And I just loved the risk and I loved the living on the edge. A lot of the courses we teach include diving and they include parachuting and shooting. The teaching can be dangerous because you are around sometimes brand new weapon shooters, people very novice to weapons, and instructors have been shot. Instructors have shot people accidentally. We just have to do everything we can to reduce the chances of an accident happening. When I first became a SEAL in the 80s, I was making less than $30,000 a year. And when I retired, less than $50,000 a year. Right now, because of the problems with trying to keep people in, they have some really nice bonus options. There's one bonus option where you can re-enlist and make $150,000 as a bonus. As an independent contractor security specialist, you make as much as you want to make almost. If you want to spend a lot of time overseas, some guys spend a year overseas at a time, they're going to make well over $100,000 a year. Yeah, I do have a dangerous job. You know, I've jumped from a lot of planes, dove in shark-infested waters, I've been shot at. One jump, it was a full equipment night, and I had a bad opening, flipped through my canopy risers, the straps that leave your parachute, and pushed my head down to the left, knocked my oxygen mask off, and dislocated my jaw under canopy. I couldn't speak, and I thought I broke my neck. And what I did with my thumbs, I put both thumbs on the back teeth and pushed down hard and relocated my jaw under canopy. That was my scariest jump. The hardest part about my job is when you give it everything you have in the class, and the students, they go overseas, and they're either hurt or killed. And you just wonder, did I say the right things? Did I do everything right? I hope he understood it. Could I have done it anything differently to save that person's life? And that's the hardest part, when somebody you've trained gets hurt or killed.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Gloomy beginnings bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Merger Monday. Merger Monday was the nickname Wall Streeters gave to the first day of the week. It's the day many companies chose to announce their latest acquisitions. Those announcements set the tone for the week's trading, sometimes leading to big gains. But now, the biggest Monday merger will probably be between worry and fear. After last week's stock market plunge, the banks that facilitate mergers have got cold feet. So, for a while anyway, bankers will be singing, "Rainy days and Mondays always get me down."
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life to read.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's that time in the show where we stop asking the questions and we start providing the answers, hopefully. And I'm joined, as always, by our dashing economics editor, Chris Farrell.
Ah!
Hello, Chris.
Hey, I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm lovely, and you're dashing.
Dashing.
How's
yes.
that?
Absolutely.
Well,
yes.
We are dashing off to get some answers for our listeners. But before we get started, do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. And our first caller is Pat from Lakewood, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do you do there in Lakewood?
I own my own company. It's a screen printing business.
Screen printing?
Yes. We print textiles, T-shirts, jackets, caps, things like that.
How did you come up with doing T-shirts?
Well, we own some record stores. A record salesman asked us if we could do some T-shirts to promote a new album that was coming out. We taught ourselves how to screen print, and I've been doing it for about 27 years.
Fascinating. What's your question for Chris today?
My husband passed away about 6 years ago, and we did own this business together, but he had a personal credit card, and he probably got that card about 17 years ago. After he passed away, our probate lawyer did notify the cardholder, which had at that point been sold off to MBNA. So we notified MBNA about 2 weeks after I was contacted by an MBNA collection agency. I told them that it was not my card, I am not responsible. And they said, oh, we're so sorry, and we certainly will help you out. Well, I had learned a short while later that they turned the account into my name.
Oh,
I said, calls that I had received, I said, well, that's illegal, you're not allowed to do that. And they said, oh, yes, we can. So at the time that he passed away, I think the card was at about $8,000. On the last report that I looked up, when I contacted the Credigy reporting agency, it's now up to $27,000. Now, I called the state attorney, and they said because MBNA is a national company, they do not have any jurisdiction. I have also talked to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I do have a complaint form, but I thought maybe before I would return that and get involved with that, I really want to talk to someone. I've talked to lawyers, I've talked to bankers, but when they find out there's no money in it for them, there's no interest and no one wants to talk to me. So what I thought that contacting your program might be the answer.
Well, Chris, this is one awful situation. I mean, is it legal?
No. It was his card and you weren't listed on it anywhere as joint holder, co-holder, anything.
That's correct.
Do you have on file with the three major credit reporting bureaus a letter explaining the situation?
Yes, we do.
Would it be possible to take this to small claims?
Yes, you could take it on small claims. The problem with small claims is that you can get a judgment in your favor, and that it doesn't mean that everything's going to be followed, which is a situation that she's in already. The thing that does puzzle me is why the credit reporting bureaus are not taking it off.
Have you sent them registered insured letters?
It wasn't registered, actually, and it's almost impossible to try to talk to anyone at those credit agencies.
But the other thing is you don't want to talk to them, because what you want to do is create a paper trail that they have to then respond to by law. As you said, with a lawyer, there's not a whole lot of money in it. So perhaps your company has a lawyer and you can add it into the list of things just that he could help you out with this.
All right. Is it possible that a lien could be put upon my house?
No, there is no way that anyone can put a lien on your house. It is a credit card debt. It is unsecured debt. And therefore, they are not going to be able to attach your home in any form or fashion.
Okay. My last question would be, I will create the paper trail to the credit agencies, but could I be opening up a can of worms? Should I just disregard it? I know that there's usually a statute of limitation. Is there such a thing? Does that ever apply?
There is a statute of limitations, but I still would create the paper trail because you're in the right.
And how much worse could it possibly get?
Right.
All right. Well, best of luck to you. Hey, will you let us know how this turns out?
Yes, I certainly will. All right. Well, thank you. And I certainly appreciate your show. I have learned so much.
Glad to hear it. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, if you've got a financial problem that seems intractable, sometimes it simply is, but we will certainly try to help. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. Let's reach into the email bag. Barbara writes in from Yucaipa, California, and she works at a company that offered profit sharing to its employees in the past. But last year, that company was taken over by another company, and they're operating under new ownership. No one's been able to tell any of the employees what's happening to the profit-sharing program. Can the new owner move these profit-sharing accounts and turn them into 401k accounts? That's what Barbara wants to know.
No, I don't see how.
I don't see how that would work either. Profit sharing is completely separate from your retirement.
Exactly.
Account.
So no, I don't see any incentive that they would have to do that either.
All right. So what are the options that they have in terms of what to do with the old company's profit sharing?
Okay. Now, there are a lot of legal protections here. Now, obviously, we don't know the circumstances here, but it doesn't sound like a very good employer if
they don't know what they're doing with the profit sharing.
And they're not communicating with the employees. If it's a large company or a larger company, it may have a human resources department. And obviously, you would contact human resources and say, hey, what's happened here? If it's a smaller company, it'd probably be the chief financial officer or the treasurer, and you'd get the information from them. But if there are a lot of protections, Department of Labor and various laws that go into play. So they have to tell the employees what happened to the profit sharing program. They may have discontinued it, mm-hmm. but there still would be existing money.
And presumably it would be a decent chunk of money, because generally when one company buys out the other, the stock will go up. So if there was profit sharing in the old company, they should have gotten a decent bump from the buyout.
Yeah. You know, this really is a question for senior management, human resources, CFO, treasurer. If you're not getting any satisfaction there, I would contact the Department of Labor.
Well, if you've got a financial problem, you could contact the Department of Labor, the DOL, but it might be simpler to contact the MMM, the Marketplace Money Mailbag. Click on the contact button for our website. It's marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, let's go to our next caller. Marty is on the line from Santa Barbara, beautiful Santa Barbara, California. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I understand that you have a question for us that has something to do with pies?
Oh, well, I was at a free dinner at Polly's Pies, and it was for people who are interested in planning for retirement. So I went to it and met with a financial planner who suggested that we take the equity in our home, about $400,000 or $500,000, and put it in a universal life insurance with equity indexed option.
Whoa, there's quite a name for you.
Uh-huh.
All right.
And then in 4 years and one day, we would put about $100,000 each year. And then we would kind of let it sit there for another 5 years. And then so after a total of 10 years, we could start pulling out like $50,000 every year.
This sounds incredibly complicated. But before we get started, what kind of pie did you get?
You know what? You're not going to believe this, but they didn't serve us pie. They served us a delicious
what?
Chicken. Yes, delicious chicken and mashed potatoes, but there was no dessert. So.
No pie at Polly's Pies.
No pie.
All right. Well, you certainly got some very interesting financial advice here. So, Chris, really break this down for us, because there are a lot of terms in here that I've never heard before.
You know, I'm just going to give my bottom line answer. You don't want to do this.
Okay.
You're not going to want to play these kinds of complicated financial games that in the end is going to pay to some salesperson a very big commission, make your financial life more complicated, and frankly, you're going to do better not doing this. Now, here we have, it's a life insurance policy. It's a flexible premium, so you don't always have to put in the same amount of money in order to maintain the policy as long as it is growing over time. The real key here, though, is the equity indexed. And what it is there'll be some sort of formula that the insurance company will come out with based on some sort of index, and it allows you to participate in some of the gain of the stock market, and typically without as much downside risk, and that gets credited to you over time. And everything that I have looked at in terms of equity indexes, whether it's annuities or life insurance, is it's, for most people, is a product to stay away from. It's very complicated. I'm sure there are some very wealthy people with some unique circumstances that this is a niche product that meets their needs. For the average person, the reason why you buy life insurance is to protect your loved ones, and that's it.
All right. So Chris, in sum, this annuity is really just a pie in the face.
I like that. I like that. Yeah, I would say so.
Well, thank you so much for the call and best of luck and
thank
hope this
you
help
so
you
much.
Out.
This has been very helpful.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Sweet or sour, we are here to answer your questions. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or head on over to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right. Final email. Greg writes in from Somerville, Massachusetts, and he's been following our summer school series, and he's definitely listening to this week's episode dealing with short sales, but he's not really interested in short selling his own home. He and his wife just placed an offer on a short sale, but the seller's agent told them that the lender may not respond for weeks. So he wants to know, first of all, Chris, how long is this process potentially going to take?
Most cases going to take more than 30 days, could take 60 days. Because remember now, with a short sale, the lender now owns the home because the person who was living there...
They basically weren't able to pay off the house.
That's right. So now the lender's in charge. The seller may accept the offer, but it's up to the lender whether or not they're going to go ahead with this.
Why would they take so long to get this done?
Well, it depends on me right now. How many homes do they have? You know, what's going
right,
on?
Right.
You know, whose desk does it go to? Which is, by the way, one of the reasons why... In a lot of cases, a big piece of advice is for the buyer to work with an agent who knows the process well. Because someone who knows what's going on may know who at the bank to get in touch with to say, hey, you know, we got this offer there. The other thing is you may want to put in your offer a time period which says, okay, this offer is good for this period of time. Again, that's an incentive for the bank to respond. The bank also has to decide whether they want to unload this home at the price that you've suggested. They also want proof that you can afford the home because they don't want to go from trouble to trouble.
Just at its most basic, is buying a home through a short sale even a good idea?
It can be a very good idea, but just recognize it's not easy money. And the people who do make money in this market tend to know what they're doing. They have an information edge. It's a much more complicated financial process when you're dealing with foreclosures or short sales.
All right. Well, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY, or visit the contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks for letting us profit from your sharing of information.
Thanks a lot.
In the battle between cubicle and corner office, score one for the little guy.
It was great walking into my, annual review and just having a little bit of information by my side to support what my compensation should have been.
There's a new way to get the upper hand in salary negotiations, and it's time for you to tell us what should or should not be on our air. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Would you ever buy a car without comparing prices? You know, go on the internet, at least look through the paper? Of course not. Then why would you, as so many employees do, walk into a salary or raise negotiation with no sense of your value or the market rate for your job? Talking about salaries is one of the last taboos around, but the internet makes it a little easier by affording you some anonymity. As Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us, there are lots of reasons to use the web for your research, but also some reasons not to.
A couple of years ago, Douglas Carr was getting ready for his annual job review. He did the usual stuff, collecting his accomplishments of the past year, creating goals for the future, and he did some digging. He brought along a salary survey from the internet.
It was great walking into my, annual review and just having a little bit of information by my side to support what my compensation should have been.
The survey showed Carr was being paid on the low end of the scale for similar jobs. he told his employer, and
they came back and made me a great offer.
A 10% raise, which certainly covered what he paid the website for his salary survey. These days, though, he can get some of that information for free. A bunch of new websites make it easy to collect information on salaries for an astonishing range of industries, jobs, and locations. Some give vague guidelines, while others take into account everything from your education to the specifics of your job description. Likewise, some are entirely free, while others charge more depending on the level of detail and personalization of the reports. Joe Giordano is founder of Payscale.com. It's a website that takes an I'll show you mine if you show me yours approach. You plug in your information, including what you're paid, and get back a report showing how you match up to others.
A lot of ways I think of it as a Kelly Blue Book for compensation. So, you know, just like a buyer and a seller of a car would be foolish not to check the market rate for that car before making a transaction, same is true now in the job market with Payscale.
He says the anonymity afforded by his website encourages honesty. Why lie if you're not really trying to impress anyone? He says he also gets better information than other sites because he goes directly to the source, the employees themselves. Carol Frohlinger works with Negotiating Women, Inc., a training and consulting company that tries to advance women in the workplace. She says getting the most money you can get isn't just about being able to afford a nice vacation or those shoes you can't live without. Your salary has all kinds of consequences for your future, consequences that you might not think about.
Some of the peripheral damage or collateral damage around that includes how much money you're able to contribute to your 401k. It also, of course, is, you know, the 3% on top of whatever that small number was originally. And on top of all of that, you know, often you have a problem then when you go for your next opportunity, because the inevitable question is, so, well, what were you making at your last job?
Not everybody's a fan of the web. Ken Cardinals with the compensation consulting firm Perlmeyer & Partners. He says he doesn't trust the numbers.
You wouldn't use it if you were an engineer and trying to develop a new formula. You wouldn't go on the internet and say, well, I'll use this. You'd instead use academic textbooks or other experts. And so in similar fashion, compensation professionals have to rely on data that we can verify and understand. And on the internet, that's often very, very hard to do.
What's often easier is to start with a range of salaries for your own company. Ask the HR department for the salary ranges and where you fit in. Then go on the internet. But as with anything you find in the big bad cyber world, use your common sense. Be suspicious if the web tells you that, say, a public radio reporter in New York earns $500,000, especially if you're not earning anything close to that. Cross-reference different sites as much as possible and try to find out how they collect their information. But remember that having more information is always in your best interest. Douglas Carr thinks it's important. He now hires new employees, and he occasionally rejects prospective employees who haven't done their salary homework. You don't want to have to say the dog ate it. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Oil prices are soaring again. This week, crude hit new records as it gets closer and closer to $80 a barrel. That's probably good news for investors who've put their money in oil ETFs, exchange-traded funds. They're betting big returns on funds that specialize in big oil. But if crude isn't your thing, Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports on the wealth of ETFs burning up the market.
Arnold Grafe works in an aircraft factory in Wichita, Kansas. About 7 months ago, the letters ETF kept popping up on his brokerage account website.
I wanted to make sure it wasn't some kind of fad or some kind of hoax.
Grafe talked to colleagues. He read up on exchange-traded funds, or ETFs as they are commonly called, in personal finance publications. This is what he found out. ETFs are a mutual fund that trades like a stock. Each ETF holds a basket of stocks that tracks an index, such as the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You can buy or sell the fund anytime during the day instead of having to wait until market close as you do with a mutual fund. And there are no minimum investments. You could buy just one share if you wanted to. Or you could do what Grafe did.
I decided to go ahead and make the plunge. I actually have bought several of them, but I put together a mix according to one of the portfolios on one of the articles I read about.
More and more Americans are taking the same plunge. There are $485 billion in exchange-traded funds. In fact, there are 534 ETFs, double the number from 1 year ago. That's according to the ETF Guide, a whole company that does nothing but track the ETF sector. The biggest advantage is the low management fee cost. Simon Meyerhofer started ETF Guide. He says the management fee of an ETF is cheaper than what you'd get on most mutual funds. For instance, 0.08% versus 1 percentage point.
Calculate what the 1% of difference, what the financial consequences will be over a 20, 30-year time horizon, and you'll be amazed how much money you can save in fees.
Let's say you put $10,000 in an S&P ETF. Your management fee for 1 year would be just $8. In a similar mutual fund, it could be $100. But not so fast. ETFs can be more expensive. When you buy an ETF, you pay a stock commission, just as if you were buying shares of IBM. Tom Rampula is head of ETF sales at the Vanguard Group. He says these trading commissions can make ETFs less of a bargain, even if you pay only $7 or $8 for a trade over the web.
If you put a little bit in on a periodic basis, the commissions and bid-ask spreads really start to eat away at your expenses, whereas the open-end mutual fund, if it's a low-cost fund, it's a much lower all-in cost.
Rampula says to take your calculator out and add up your total costs with an ETF versus a mutual fund. And Rampula says to watch out for ETFs that are too tiny. Wall Street is now creating very narrow, exotic ETF varieties, like the HealthShares Dermatology and Wound Care Fund. Jeff Feldman is the chairman of XShares, the company that created the Dermatology Fund. His funds can have as few as 20 stocks in them. He says his ETFs are for an investor who doesn't want to bet on just one company's new technology, but on the entire subsector.
They're all pretty niche, like ophthalmology, orthopedic repair, patient care services, respiratory and pulmonary diseases, infectious diseases.
ETFs that focus on niche segments of the market can be volatile. If that segment of the market tanks, so will your ETF. Even Feldman, the guy who's trying to sell you these funds, says you shouldn't allocate more than 4% of your portfolio to his niches. The next frontier for ETFs is active management. Those new ETF funds effectively throw the index away altogether. Managers actively pick stocks or bonds, just as they do for ordinary mutual funds. And someone's got to pay the salary of the ETF fund manager. You've guessed it. Expect those ETF management fees to rise. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace Money.
All right, you want to learn more about ETFs? We'll have links to sites where you can DYR, do your research. Just visit marketplace.org. Every few weeks, we like to turn the mic around and let you sound off with your criticisms and compliments for the show. We got several responses to the letter we read on the air from a listener in Montana who urged us to get serious. Jacqueline Moss called in from Queens, New York.
As a self-identified financial disaster, I'm responding to a comment Tess received telling her and Marketplace Money to get serious. Please do not. The little awareness and knowledge that I do have about financial matters is all due to Marketplace Money. I hate normal financial programs. They tend to be dull and just a repetition of stock numbers. You make financial issues easily comprehensible, relevant, and fun.
For the last few months, we've been profiling an engaged couple, Tiffany Leungren and Michael Fox, as they prepare to join their financial lives in September. Mikhail Yulinich listens to the show in Mountain View, California, and he thinks that in our reporting, we missed one very simple question.
What I find amazing about this series is the fact that no one questions the sanity of the whole enterprise. My wife and I went to the city hall to get married. The wedding cost us less than $200. We are not poor. Our combined income is well over $200,000 a year. But we would much rather take 5 additional vacations in Europe or Hawaii than donate money to the wedding industry.
Regular listeners know we've been featuring a segment we call Summer School, trying to parse out common financial terms. Recently, economist Chris Lowe explained P.E. ratio. S. Sadner of Manhattan Beach wrote in to thank us for the segment, but he has a question about Chris's statement that a low P.E. ratio is preferred. Low in relation to what, he asks. He says he looked up Whole Foods, and its P.E. is 29.23, while Federal Express is 17.83. Does that mean FedEx would be preferable to Whole Foods? So we called Chris for clarification and caught him hanging around Wrigley Field waiting for a Cubs game.
The P.E. is the price that you pay for a unit of earnings. So if a company has a high P.E. relative to other companies, it means people are willing to pay more for a unit of current earnings. So you can't necessarily compare P.E.s of one company to the P.E. of another, because one might be a growth company, one might be a mature company. But you certainly can compare a P.E. of a company to its historical average, and that's definitely true for the market as a whole as well.
And finally, a few weeks ago, in an introduction to a story about all those credit card offers that come in the mail, I mentioned that my family managed to stop them. A lot of you wanted to know how, so here are a couple of methods to opt out. One is the website optoutprescreen.com. We'll have a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. You can also send a letter to the Direct Marketing Association. We'll have a link to them on our site. We'll also list a URL for helpful hints from the Federal Trade Commission. Keep those questions and comments coming. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, how about we talk about some very rich folks?
Okay.
Hedge fund managers, private equity takeover mavens. These people make staggering sums of money, but some folks are a little fed up with that. Now there's this dispute that's broken out in Washington over the taxes that they pay on those earnings.
Maybe we should say the lack of taxes that they pay.
Exactly. So you want to give us the big picture here?
Okay, it's really easy to get lost in the details. But here's the rub. These managers you mentioned, the hedge fund guys, the private equity folks, they call a big chunk of their income capital gain.
Mm-hmm.
Now that means they pay a low 15% rate on their income. But you, I, most people listening to this broadcast, they fork over 25% to 35% of earnings to Uncle Sam.
But there are some proposals in Washington to close that loophole.
Well, I'm stunned, but frankly, it's a close call whether Congress will do anything. But if you ask me, which of course they're not, but if you ask me, they should. Here's the straight story. Let's eliminate the tax gap between capital gains and ordinary income. Radical? Well, we did it before with Ronald Reagan's Tax Reform Act of 1986.
So you'd like us to go back to Ronald Reagan's Tax Reform Act of 1986?
I think that was a step forward. It was one of the best tax acts that has ever been passed. And unfortunately, you can look at tax history since then. Congress and the presidents running away from it. Bad move.
I assume that we're talking here about the tax cuts that the Bush administration put in place several years ago. How is it that a multimillionaire hedge fund manager now pays a lower tax rate than a secretary?
All right. It's really an anomalous situation, but let's just break it down. The technical term is carried interest, which all that means is that in a typical private equity fund, hedge fund, the manager shares in 20% of the profits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they get two tax advantages from that. One, they defer taxes until they realize the gain. But here's the other thing. They call that deferred compensation capital gains. But it's really a fee for, you know, running the fund, managing the fund, and they should be paying ordinary income tax rates on it. It's an anomalous situation. And it should be ended.
How did we get to the point where income is not taxed as income?
It's called labeling, and it's called having some very creative people. And Paul Krugman,
columnist for the New York Times.
Columnist for New York Times made a very good point. And he said, how can Henry Kravis, which is one of the great leveraged buyout pioneers of the past quarter century, pay a lower tax rate capital gains than Paul Krugman does on his book royalties, mm-hmm. which he pays ordinary income tax rates. Does it make sense? No.
Obviously, there must have been some reasoning behind this. Taxing capital gains and ordinary income at the same rate, won't that imperil the economy and economic growth? Didn't all this stem from the notion that tax cuts are great and it'll help the economy?
Exactly. Part of this commentary comes from a piece that Princeton University economist Alan Blinder wrote recently. Lots of people writing about this. And the simple point is, lower rate on capital gains is supposed to boost investment. There is no evidence that it boosts investment. There really isn't. Very mixed record. Let's get rid of it. And in doing so, we'll also get rid of this horrible anomaly of the private equity managers paying a lower rate of taxes than their secretaries.
You said earlier that it's a close call whether Congress is going to do anything. But when we're talking about the income tax rate for such a small group of wealthy people, isn't it kind of easy for Congress to say, you know what, we're going to tax you like everybody else?
They play the Washington game very well. They have high-paid lobbyists mm-hmm. that are running around the Hill. We're entering into the presidential election season. We're entering into the campaign season. And frankly, I think there's a lot of concern in Washington about passing this kind of law and hurting campaign coffers.
All right. The Straight Story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our San Jose Investment Club talks up the steamier side of stocks.
I find unusual investment-y things sexy.
Yes.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes. We wish her the best of luck in her new career. With Nancy Fargali, Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. This week, thanks to Tim Bomba and Phil Richards. And a special welcome to our new listeners on station WMFE in Orlando. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.